This episode of Voyager Ungraded is sponsored by CNC Timelapse. Be sure to check out his channel on YouTube and subscribe. Welcome back to the Voyager Ungraded podcast. Today's episode is a conversation from our live stream about how we go about making our abandoned camera series, how we edit our videos, tips and tricks to being a YouTuber in our space, and a lot more. We're also joined by George Marsak, who is sponsoring this podcast and came on to ask us questions that our viewers and he have been dying to know. So let's get into this. Welcome to the Voyager Ungraded podcast. And we're here to, talk about abandoned cameras that we've been doing for a while and also hitting 50,000 subscribers. But joining me here is a big friend, big time friend of the channel, who started out watching this channel and wanted to join us in that. He's actually sponsoring this episode, the podcast, this live stream, and some other stuff coming out. And that his name is George Marsak. So, George, go ahead and tell everyone a little bit about yourself.
Sure. My name is George. I am the creator of the CNC Timelapse YouTube channel. And kind of fell in love with this channel as I kind of dived into working on my own channel and did some research and whatnot, and came across Frame Voyager, of course, and all the awesome documentaries and videos. And so when I started working on my own channel, came up with the idea of designing and building my own CNC machine, and I figured, hey, why not? I'll document it, see if others will enjoy the ride as well, and kind of learn from my mistakes, hopefully, and I can learn from the community as well. So hopefully someday I'll have a community as awesome as the Frame Voyager channel.
Yeah, awesome to have you on. I'm glad he's going to be here. He's going to actually be asking me a bunch of questions about our production work, how we put all of this stuff together. It is kind of a question that we get asked a lot. I think best coming from someone who's wanting to learn or even watching it, where I'm probably asking, thinking of questions that I wouldn't even be able to ask. So it's awesome to have you here. Always love getting support from the community towards our content, which is awesome. What is the first thing you would like to ask me about our production process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously with any project, I know even for myself, my own project, I just kind of want to know like what your thought process is, especially, talk about the abandoned camera series, for example. If you're going to, try to create a new video, what is kind of where do you begin with your process?
So a lot of that's the hardest thing when we got started doing this. I kind of sort of fell into it. When I found the series, like I was trying to actually make a different video. I'm like, oh, I should make it like this. I was trying to find some new content. And when this worked, the style worked. I was like, oh, I could do this with so many other things. But the idea really comes from like, what are the abandoned cameras? And what's like that interesting angle you can take for each one? Because each one has its own little story, its own unique history. And obviously some of them are way more dramatic and still alive than others. So like the Fran 8K, for example, sometimes you just like fall into really good ones. So that's really what we're looking for is like, what's its place in history? What was it used on? Does it have a lot of information or resources on it? And if it's kind of like super obscure and it just doesn't have any videos and no one's really touched it and it's not really from a company that people would really know or you could find stuff for and it didn't have a significant moment, we kind of push those back a little bit so we can spend some time like researching versus the ones that like, like the Star Wars camera. There's plenty of information about that digital camera that they used for the Phantom Menace. And we'll just like a little bit of a part of the Phantom Menace. And then was Attack of the Clones. So that's kind of where we started, is looking for that interesting. What's that interesting little tidbit that we can find to tell the story with? Because otherwise we're just talking about specs. And while specs are cool, you do want to like have that fun story element and add some drama, which, some people don't love that we add the drama into it, but
yeah, I think that's one thing that I've always appreciated with your videos too, is and what separates the Frame Voyager videos from other, like as far as technology goes, it's not about the technology necessarily. There's about the story behind it, and that's one thing that always keeps me engaged in the videos, and something that I strive to do hopefully for my videos moving forward too. So yeah, that's awesome. When it comes to, obviously you do the research, right? You're trying to establish the that particular story. Is there anything that you try to maybe avoid? You know, it's, again, looking forward to like what to avoid, what not to do.
Yeah. So I will say I started off doing like all the research, all the production process by myself. And I have to give a big shout out to both my writers and researchers that help me a lot now make the episode so much better because there's more than just my eyes looking at it. Massey and Elwood, they're great. They keep the content going as much as otherwise we wouldn't be able to come out with content as fast as we do.
The areas of work that you kind of anticipate will, you know, you probably want to avoid, you know, I guess going down a rabbit hole. Content wise and.
Yeah, I mean, look, I like to be a little edgy with our content because you got to add a little bit of drama in it. Some people say that's like a shtick, you know, that's like, oh, that's just their thing. And he's not really serious about it. But we actually do a lot of hard research into things. And I mean, we're not going to get everything right. All of this stuff is like ancient history that's been wrapped in like just the deep, dark places of the web that you have to go find it. And then you try to find the like sources and stuff, which we've had like it, as we've developed the series, our list of sources and network has grown to help get better information in. So usually the thing we try to do is make sure we can get as close to accurate as possible. My researchers and writers will go get everything. We put everything in links. Everything's hyperlinked. We put it actually into an Obsidian database that you can actually go view. We're going to start posting those in the links of the video here soon, but you can actually see the spider web and see where, like for each of our videos, how it all connects, what sources we're pulling from, all of that. After they're done with that process, I go through it, cut out things, and I'm like, I don't want to talk about this or delve into this. So we try not too hard go after specific people and kind of let the story tell itself as much or let others tell the story in specific parts. Because our goal is never to like bash people, just kind of like report a little bit what's right. going on, but also try to add a little bit of drama.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense there too. And you kind of mentioned too, with regard to like, you know, data storage, and accessing that, you have a team that you work with. Like kind of on the, I guess on the hardware perspective, like when you're gathering your information, I mean, are you doing it like, are you just keeping a repository somewhere that mm-hmm. you can, you know, just kind of, you know, share with other people? Or like you mentioned you specifically early on when you were doing your videos, you know, you're kind of doing it by yourself. What are some lessons there that you'd like to maybe share some improvements? Cause I know for myself, man, it takes a while to make a video and
some of it's like really sourcing stuff like and double checking on sources. Cause you know, there's a lot of stuff written and when you're trying to find like a lot of stuff beforehand, it's much easier now that people actually like are happy that we're doing it. So even in like the ones we're working on now, we've got plenty of abandoned camera series episodes coming up and they're all being like, we're just taking more time on them. They're probably going to be longer because we're getting more interviews and people are interested in actually talking about these cameras now. So I think that was kind of the lesson is like early on, I was doing like one a week for like, I think the first 10 episodes or something. And then I realized that like, we can't keep up with
that. That's not maintainable. I don't understand how you could even do that. It's a full-time job by itself.
Yeah. So like learning how to let go of some of the stuff and like here, have someone else do it, like write it. And the two of them were great. Like they're both love documentary research. You can actually check out their channels on our, we have them linked in our channel page if you want to go find them. They're really great. So, I mean, that's like a couple of lessons from that. Like we've gotten some feedback from people about certain things that maybe weren't fully right or. And I think that's the hardest part is trying to cover all the perspectives because there's always several and everyone thinks they have like a little piece of the story and that it didn't go this way. And oh, you know, so sometimes it's going to be hard because when you come out with the content, like you find out like, oh, there's this other story that like no one ever mentioned before, but it came out now because you actually like brought out some of this stuff that no one's really brought out before.
Sure. Yeah. Now you obviously, you know, you have a career doing this kind of or work in general, like, you know, doing video, you know, videography and cinematography and so forth. Like when you, do you have a preference between like the type of work that you do? Obviously Frame Voyager and the Abandoned Camera series is awesome. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that would be something that you'd love to pursue, you know, maybe as a full-time thing, maybe, I don't know. what are your preferences or types of, I guess your dream scenario, what would be the best thing that can happen to you right now?
I would love to just do full-time like YouTube work. It would be fun. But I still think that I sharpen my skills by doing a lot of other things. Like, just like YouTube has probably really sharpened my editing skills. Still good to go out and do stuff for clients and still like maintain a lot of that like filming and the production process. And then like, I feel like both kind of builds on each other. So I kind of like both. I would say I like editing at times better, but I do like filming at specific times as well. And I really like, we did some stuff early on in the channel that didn't get a ton of views, but more like cinematic travel documentary type stuff where I went out to Alaska to the middle of nowhere and filmed. That's probably one of my more better technical like filming. I just love how that one came together. But I mean, I still love doing like, I love documentary work, and I'm actually like, from doing YouTube, a lot of it's actually, I've found things that work in YouTube to actually be able to offer to clients. I'm like, oh, why don't we do something this way? Here's a content idea you've never thought of. So in some way, even though, you know, I still have to do the other like normal stuff until the channel grows a little bit more. It's still helpful to have both.
Yeah.
And then both kind of help each other out with different things.
Would you say for somebody who has thought about maybe producing YouTube videos, but maybe are a little skeptical that they could do it, what would you say to somebody who is maybe has a thought process of maybe starting there? What, you know, would you encourage them, or you'd say, nah, don't do it. It's too much work.
I mean, I think YouTube's good to do. Like, there's no, I mean, if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, like, you still learned valuable skills. Yeah. I mean, I started doing the YouTube stuff, and you can go back and look at some of our early stuff. It was not good, but it was just like, oh, let me just do this. This is a great like way to do stuff that I can't, you know, when you're doing corporate work or like other projects, you don't get to control everything and you have to do everything the way you want to or experiment as much as you want.
Yeah,
I totally. Kind of use this as a way to experiment and test things and like, and you do my own creative expression and things, you know, the way I wanted to do it. So I think like if you're going into it, you should definitely go into it saying like, I want to do well in this. How do I learn it? Where are the good resources on YouTube? Like, I would say like vidIQ, Channel Makers, and there's a couple others that I'm always bouncing back and forth between different people who talk about how to make content and like the analytics behind it. And here's how you should edit a YouTube video and think about it. And one thing I always do is I'm not looking necessarily at video content within my niche. So I will check out different camera videos and things going on in the industry for information, for all that. I don't really watch them as like for fun or for like research, where I'll go. And a lot of the ideas I get for videos are not from this industry, you know, so that's kind of how I approach it, is to bring some of that over to here, 'cause it's not really being done. All that to say, like, if you want, there should be nothing stopping you from doing a YouTube channel. And as long as you're approaching it with like, yeah, let me try to see what this can do. At the end of the day, it should be something that's fun, that you enjoy doing, and just figure out a good pace that you don't burn yourself out on. That's what I would say.
It's experience. You gain experience, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's made me, at this point I've done like 200 videos, I think, about on YouTube. Not even including like client videos, just going back and watching other videos, like, and different techniques I used that is just built upon each other. And where all of a sudden it used to be like, oh, YouTube videos were the easier ones to edit, my client ones were the harder ones to edit. It's completely different now. Like, YouTube's really difficult to edit. Like, that's, and my client ones, because it's like, I've developed all these processes. It's so much easier to do client work now, because I know how to go through processes,
sort of situation where
and you just know, like, with doing YouTube content, you just know how to cut content together because you've made so many videos. And I think that's one thing when you're doing client videos all the time, is you're not doing something every week all the time. You always have projects here or there, so it kind of gives you it gives you a time in between to like practice things and try different things that you don't necessarily want to try on a client video.
Right. Gotcha. So when it comes to like your sourcing your material too, obviously client videos are going to be different than doing YouTube, you know, videos, research, specifically documentaries and so forth. Like, what are some resources that you go to be able to get your content?
As far as like trying to find sources for stuff, or
sources for stuff, or even stock material, or things that you recommend.
Yeah. So as far as stock stuff, Artlist. I mean, that's the hard thing with some of the companies is like I love all of them. There's different ones I use for different things. Artlist is great. Artlist is probably my primary music thing. That's what I love it because it's like musicians playing music. But for like stuff in the videos, you know, just like any stock video sites is always good to have things you can pull from quickly. One of the ones I really like is Storyblocks because you can actually like have a plugin in your video editor and you can just download it directly into your folder instead of having to like go online, search it out there. You can actually do it in the system, which is kind of how I've developed my editing style. Now, as far as sources, they're all over the place for our videos. It just depends on what it is. So we'll try to hunt down people who are connected to it. One of the abandoned episodes we have coming up, we actually have one of the CEOs who created this company around the camera that we're actually doing an interview with about this camera. And it's got some fun, spicy early camera days, like type of, you know, early digital cinema camera type stories. That's awesome. That are going to be involved in it. So it's going to be a lot of fun. So that's kind of how, and then like articles, we try to stick within industry news articles with people who have like a history of being reputable as much as possible. And then sometimes you just go look for like fun dirt in like backroom chat forums and stuff, because that's where all the fun conversations happen.
Gotcha. So, you know, when it comes to actual, you know, work that you're doing, what kind of equipment do you typically work with, you know, from production standpoint?
That's a fun question. We use so much different stuff. I mean, it's hard. I primarily have used Blackmagic for the most part. And I think that's one thing that I would encourage most people. I'm not loyal to necessarily any camera brand at this point. I'm open to using anything. So I've gone from using, you know, all my Blackmagic stuff. I have a Pocket 4K, Pocket 6K Pro, an Ursa G2, Ursa 12K. I've also got a bunch of Sony cameras. I got a Sony FX30, a Sony A7 IV, Sony A7 III. I started off using the Sony A7S to film. So it really just depends on like, my suggestion to everyone is like, find out what exactly it is that you are trying to do and what works best with your workflow. Because at this point, there's so many good cameras that it doesn't even matter like what you use. It's just learning how to use that specific camera. So I'll fluctuate between different things. Like right now I'm using the FX30 because it's easy to hook up and do a live stream through. It looks great. It's got the autofocus. Other times I'll use the Ursa G2. Like for most of our videos, I'm using an Ursa G2 with like a Vespid Prime, like a Vespid, 35 millimeter or 50 millimeter or something on there for our videos whenever I'm like on it. So, which is probably overkill, but it just determines what, you know, what you do. I also have been using the Ronin 4D, which we're doing a project with DJI on that, which hopefully will come out soon, that we're working on. But yeah, so that's kind of my equipment overall. We just have a lot of different things for a lot of different projects because our projects are very varied, probably more so than I would say most normal contractors work.
for YouTube channel, I mean, what would you recommend there?
For a YouTube channel? You could do it with your phone if you wanted to. Like, at the end of the day, YouTube content comes out. I mean, look at like, was it Ryan Trahan? Ryan Trahan? Yeah, I think that's, yeah. Is one guy that's great. Like, probably films with like a not like, at this point, probably a better camera. But like, you could do most of the stuff he's doing with a cell phone. And then it's not like perfectly set up. It's not like perfectly angled and or like super aesthetic. Unless you're wanting to be a Peter McKinnon or like you're wanting to do short films on YouTube, like I just start off with whatever you can. Start making content and learn how to like make content that actually is interesting and entertaining and can hold people's attention. Because at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to. It's better to have better audio and a video that actually like leads towards something and is interesting than just like super aesthetic video or footage. There are a ton of people that I really respect on YouTube that their channels are very, very aesthetically pleasing, but their content is kind of the same thing after a while. And you're not, you know, I'm not watching like a documentary or something in that kind of sense. So you want to have it more than just like, oh, the best camera, the best lens. It's got to be perfectly color graded. It's got to be perfectly shot. If it's out of focus, oh, like as long as you can sell the content and you actually understand how to make interesting, like an interesting story out of your content, you're fine.
Yeah. I think for myself, that's one thing that I think I'm struggling with right now, because I've got a Ursa G1 in 4.6K Pro. And it's a little overkill for what I'm trying to shoot, because it's a little bit bigger camera. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right there.
So you can see the challenges of filming with a camera like that. And of course, there's so much extra on there. You know, it's just totally overkill. So with regard to like even production and setup, how do you usually, you know, when you shoot, for example, you know, I'm assuming anyway, when you're working with your client, you kind of ascertain what sort of situation you're going to be in. What do you do with regard to lighting?
So half the time, like a lot of my stuff is not stuff that's very, I would say, like is like controlled. Like you'll get photos from the clients or places. Like I don't really always have the luxury of like pre-scouting places or having the luxury of really lighting things a lot of the time. For some of my content, sometimes I get to do nice interviews where I get a couple hours to set up, which is awesome. So usually I just try to bring as much as lighting as I can, cause it's traveling. And I usually have to fly with all the equipment or like rent it and send it all out there. So, I use everything from like NAND lights to small rigs lights to aperture lights. The one thing I would say is like having like a nice big dome diffuser is really nice to just like spread that, especially in certain places when you just need a lot of light. But I would travel with like two or three lights as much as you can with things. Try to get ones, especially if you know your clients are going to be asking you to shoot near daylight stuff that are higher powered. Like I think it is worth investing in a light that is both. You can change the color temperature on. And the brightness on is definitely kind of a win, I would say, especially for traveling. Because, I mean, that's how most of my stuff, like, I don't have any clients, like, locally. So I'm always flying somewhere. So I'm always having to take into consideration, like, what's the best equipment to take? And that's usually how it goes. And a lot of times when we get lighting, because it's all run and gun, like, we show up, we have to film right away. So you get used to shooting with a lot of natural lighting and trying to make it work, even in dark situations, which comes down to understanding your camera and kind of figuring all that out.
Yeah, like what the ISO rating is on the camera, optimal. Have you ever run into a situation where you went out to do a shoot and you didn't bring something that you needed?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Tripods, specifically the... this is stupid because I should have some more like when this has happened, but I just like... I'm always changing how my like kits, my travel kits are built out depending on the projects. But sometimes I'll forget like the base plates are still on the cameras. So I'll have the tripod, but I won't have a base plate. So thankfully, like I'll make it work with like light stands or some other janky setup. And to be honest, that is something you should get used to. You should try to prepare as much as you can and be on top of it as much as you can. You will still have outlet times where things break on you or you just like totally forget something. There's so many details and so many things going on. It's just inevitable. So you could, like the best advice I give to people who are working on corporate shoots or any of this, like just have, I know you're like dying inside, but don't let the talent like feel that like negative energy. I would say like stay fun, stay positive. And that's why I also like when I bring when I bring contractors on shoots and stuff, I like them to be very chill, very like fun, easygoing. When things are going wrong, they don't like flip out and freak out, because it's not a good reflection to the client. I'm trying to make sure the client doesn't even know there's issues and we're just resolving them. And it's
right,
fun.
Right.
If there's a problem, if something messes up, you laugh, you make it more kind of fun.
Right. That makes total sense. So when you get to a shot though, like obviously, you know, again, this is just in general as well. But when it comes to audio, you can mention, a good YouTube video, you know, should have good audio. What do you do in various circumstances, you know, to mitigate that, you know, also too, putting together, something in, you know, in production.
Yeah. So for YouTube stuff, I used to get criticized all the time because I would have a boom mic in front of my face, but I just liked how it sounded and I would get nice clear audio and people wouldn't complain. But some people did complain. That's not the way you're supposed to use it. You're missing an opportunity to teach people. I'm like, I'm not trying to, like, if someone thinks that they need to put a boom arm in front of their face with their microphone for their client, they're like, that's their own problem for doing that. But to me, audio is important. And it's always having multiple sources of audio and different ways of doing it. So I like to travel with multiple boom mics. If I'm doing client stuff, multiple lapels, I've kind of upgraded my equipment over the years on what I use. I use DPA labs, which are very, very, they don't break very easily. They almost sound like boom mics, in my opinion, a little bit. They're very expensive, but like when I'm filming in very loud environments or places where I just need them to perform, it works. So, but like just good, get some labs, learn the best ways to mic up people in different situations, because the problem is you're like, you just don't think about it until you get on set. And some people wear like the weirdest stuff, or even like trying to like mic a shirt like this. Sure, you could tape it to the inside of here, or you could put it on the collar, but you have to understand, like, putting on the collar, how am I going to edit that in the audio side when I go back to production? And also having on the back end, I do have a funny sticker on my case from DPA that says fix it in post, but they mark it out. But for me, it's like, yeah, fix it in post. To have really good software. So one of the things I use in addition with Audition is iZotopes, which is audio restoration software that can really fix a lot of your problems, especially with noise, or like if you just have really terrible audio and you just need to fix it. It can suggest some things to you, and it can really clean up things to the point where it's like, it's fine. It's better than it would be if you just tried to do it with a normal audition. So that's kind of one of the processes I use. One of the interesting things that are happening now is Adobe's voice enhance thing that they have, which is, it works sometimes, but it doesn't always work. And sometimes it has weird things. But I think in the future, AI, and a lot of that's going to help with mics and stuff. But I would suggest, audio learning. I know it's a hard point for video editors, but like, take the time to learn how to, like, at least semi-properly, like, know how things work and set up a good workflow and multiple different workflows for different mics and test things out. And like that way, if you know how things can work, you can save yourself in a lot of times where the audio is just terrible.
With regard to, you know, your workflow, you're working in your projects and so forth. I noticed even when we were talking before, setting up the live stream, you know, your production speed is amazing to me. Like, and I'm new to this, but you can crank stuff out really quick. So generally speaking, like, you know, how do you manage your media? What do you do with regard to, you know, tracking your footage and plugins and effects? And you know, I guess what software do you, work out of to, you know, improve your process?
Speaking of how quickly we are able to get to projects, because we do turn things around. I will say this month we've only released one video, but typically we're a little bit better. It's really nailing down your process, having things like, I feel like even in different parts of our content, things are so similar. Learning how to, let me just go through our production stuff. So usually if I have an idea, I'll put it in a Trello board, which is just like almost like you can move different cards around to different sections. So we know where things are in production process. From there, the idea, like, we'll get a title, a thumbnail. You want to make sure your idea is like either like something that's trending or something that, you know, people are searching for, or that if you post it, people will probably generally watch it or your audience will like it. Like, a lot of our abandoned stuff is not trending. It's not really searchable. People aren't really searching for it, but people love the content. So it just gets pushed a little bit more. That's the first thing. Make sure you have a good video as best as you can. And then kind of from the editing standpoint, when I get into it, the best advice I ever got early on for editing was the best thing that I ever got from advice for editing was to approach it like you would in segments or in like an assembly line process. Don't try to just sit there and edit. Like, as you're going along, you're editing both the audio, the video, the graphics, everything, just like in a linear timeline. So when I start off, we'll film everything. I'll go through, I'll cut down all the mistakes, cut down, and I'll get it down to where I want it. And then I'll go and section out the different places that if we have things we want to put in between it, if we have an intro, different things, I'll add those in. And then you just work from the beginning, lay things down, and then go back through and add things as you're, instead of like trying to do everything as you're going along, because you're switching like almost the creative parts of your brain or the task segments. So like you're constantly switching to a different task, where if you just did the same process over and over again, and then go back to things that take longer at other times, instead of just like, the problem is, you know, you get really excited about an idea, you start editing it, and then like all you've wasted all this time and you haven't got anywhere near like getting like anything done. So that's then you feel like, man, I haven't really gotten anything done. And then you kind of give up to like the next day. So it's good to like, good motivation to like keep it going in an assembly line process, work on one piece of things like at once, and then learn to the point where like, okay, it's good. Now I can look at this from a creative perspective and like, I won't lose focus on it. So that's, I would say is a good piece of advice. Also, again, like I said earlier, experience editing, just like the more you edit, the more you see things, you're learning how to work your way yourself out of like bad, like cuts or like tricky things. Like, how do I get this to work? Does this feel right? Why is this not working? Why isn't it working? You just gain so much experience that you don't even think about it anymore. Almost like, I would say to someone who's a musician, because I play guitar or used to play guitar a lot. When you first learn how to strum a guitar, you're like learning in patterns. But after a while, you know all the patterns, and then you start like you don't even think about it really. And a lot of times you're just blending different patterns together at different times when you're strumming, and you don't think about it. It's kind of the same thing with editing. When you've been doing it and you have a lot of experience with like specific problems, you just kind of like you intuitively know how to like try some different things to fix it and get it to work. Yeah. Or if something's just not working, you can tell it's not working.
And you mentioned something to me too earlier with regard to starting or picking with starting with a thumbnail and a title, mm-hmm. and then building a video around that, or you know, kind of maintaining that theme. That's something I definitely will try, because I've got three videos that are, you know, well into the works of it, mm-hmm. but I have not finished them at all. I get in, I'm like, all right, this is going to be great. And then, you know, I get the part that I really cared about, and then there's the rest. Just have to finish the rest. I was like, okay.
It is hard, because you have to like think of, like, it is really good to think about titles and thumbnails, because you can figure out if your idea works. Like, I don't always follow it. There's times that I'm like rushed. You can ask my Discord community, because I'm always sending them thumbnails at the last, like, what do you guys think about this? Like, you think this one's good, or should I do something else? But yeah, like, it's always good to come up with a title or a general idea of what your title's going to be, something that's catchy, and understanding. It's almost like understanding, how do I take this really piece of interesting content, but also configure it in a way, in a topical sense, that people will think it's interesting and will want to click on it. Even if it's like a little clickbaity. And some people will accuse me for about, mostly not YouTubers, people who are actually like really into you doing YouTube, is titling. I think there was recently, and a lot of times people get on me about, like, you know, I'll have like the truth about the digital IMAX camera or whatever. Like, I'm obviously not like saying, what I'm saying is like, all I'm giving you as best information as I can. Is it like the ultimate, like, all, you know, all whatever truth? No, it's a YouTube title. And like, everyone does that. And most people who are on YouTube understand, it's like, okay, he's not saying like, it's the truth. You know, so I think you gotta play into that a little bit, but you also have to deliver on what your title is saying. So, like,
dig into it deeper. The truth is revealed. Yeah.
This last video we did on, and if you guys haven't watched it, go watch it, because it is one of those slow rising videos, but it's on this director who didn't exist, and all these like famous directors would use as a pseudonym. So we tested some different thumbnails, actually worked really well, that some people didn't like. We put like George Lucas and Spielberg on there and just said, not real, ? And some people were like, this is clickbait. And I'm like, but it's like the lightest kind of clickbait. Like, and then like the title is like, this director didn't, the legendary director who didn't exist, which is true. Like, and it actually is kind of makes sense. But you want to clickbait it, but you also want to like clickbait them to watch something that's not even related to your video.
Right.
If that makes sense. Yeah. I think that's when you start getting a lot more negative feedback, because most of it I'm looking for in the likes to dislikes ratio, because we can still see dislikes in the back end on our videos. You can tell when people are upset, or like really upset. But for the most part, even in those, we're like in the high 95 to 98% like to dislike ratio. And most of the comments are like, it's usually not that negative. So, because at the end of the day, your goal is to get other people to watch your content. And how do you frame it in a way that will get them to watch it? Because some topics are really interesting, but there's nothing about the topic that will get people to click on it in like a traditional sense. So you're trying to like inject something into it, if that makes sense.
Most and likely to your community that gets the joke, so to speak. That, you know, like, you know, when I saw that that title, I just laughed. I just laughed on it, clicked on it. I was like, oh, we're going to do this.
Which I'm expecting it. I know people, like, that's the thing. I'm doing YouTube, you have to have a little bit of a thick skin and just be like, most of the time I'll just like post funny like comments that I get from people. I actually like anytime, like it's fun.
Yeah. So what software do you typically use to edit?
So we're going into now the topic that everyone loves to like act shocked about, the fact about me, which is, what do I edit with? What is my favorite editing software? I can tell you right now, I do not use DaVinci Resolve. I am not part of those who I'm not part of those who've made the jump. I am still using Premiere Pro. I've used Premiere Pro forever. And it's not that I don't think DaVinci Resolve is an excellent video editor. It's just I am so ingrained in Premiere Pro. I've got it hooked up with like two stream decks, a loop deck, custom, like so many custom built third-party plugins that help me do things so quickly. Also, I do things in Premiere that probably shouldn't be done in Premiere, but should probably be done in After Effects, but that also saves me a lot of time. So, I mean, plugins I use are like Red Giant by Maxon. That helps with a lot of, I would say, like quick needing like some effects type stuff. Film Convert's a good one. I like using Film Convert for specific projects. AE Juice is one that I used a lot. And it's actually better now that I got a new computer with a better graphics card. But it's like so many different graphic stuff that you can... It's very easy to select and do. It's almost like this own little program for Premiere Pro. And that's where I use a lot of my graphics and stuff like that. And then Film Impact is where I use a lot of transitions and stuff. So I try to have as much as I can built into Premiere Pro. So as I am doing things, I don't have to go other places to do stuff. So again, it's editing efficiency for me. And I know I don't experience as many crashes in the traditional sense of Premiere Pro. The crashes that I experience would also probably crash any other NLE because... I try to do way too much when it comes to graphic stuff, but it's fine. Now I got the graphics card to handle it. But yeah, so I think it doesn't really matter which editing software you use, especially not for YouTube. I think Premiere Pro offers me like a ton of it just works well with my workflow. I like the ability to go audition and stuff like that. And it just works well with all my custom plugins and stuff. So I guess I'm trying to figure out a better way to answer that, but like Premiere Pro is where I'm at, and I can pump content out of Premiere Pro, and as much as I would love to do more in DaVinci Resolve, it would take me way too long to figure out and transition everything into it, I guess.
Right. Do you have any hardware that you use in connection with Premiere at all that helps for editing, like NLEs or, you know, anything like that?
Yeah. So a couple like things that I think are not necessarily as well known would be for custom hotkeys. There's this program called Excalibur that will actually allow you to do it, like has some kind of weird script thing where it allows you to actually hotkey things that Premiere Pro does not actually allow you to hotkey. So like if you need to fill the frame with an image because it's not fitting properly, it'll just like automatically do it for you. It's like a hotkey for nesting files, for all these other like effects that are great. Also, I would for like doing keyframing and stuff on any program, Loop Deck. Loop Deck's great. I love using Loop Deck because it's got, let me see actually. So Loop Decks are great because it gives you a bunch of little options, and it actually has a lot of haptic controls on each of these, which is usually lit up when it's plugged in. But you have all these little knobs that you can use in Premiere Pro, and these like work with DaVinci Resolve too. But it's very easy to like keyframe things or zoom in or move things in specifically instead of trying to do it with a mouse, and it saves a lot of time. That's kind of the stuff I do when it comes to that. Stream Decks are big. I pretty much don't even use a keyboard for stuff. Like when I'm editing, I have it all built out like a almost like I'm playing a video game, you know, like with the how everything's close together.
Sure.
So everything I use a lot, especially with cutting. And then you can even build different presets that are for specific different parts of the edit. So you can kind of see like, and I'm barely even scratching the surface of how complicated some of my stuff is, but like it's just little tricks and techniques I've learned over the years to make my content editing faster and just to make everything flow together faster. So I'm not having to like, when you're doing processes over and over again, if you can cut a couple of seconds off of them, it saves you so much time. So that's kind of where I'm.
That makes sense. I know, like I said, my limited experience, it's so tedious, right?
Yeah.
There's just so much to do. And that I guess it would save time.
And I would say, because this is a mountain of stuff I'm talking about. Take it one thing at a time. Find one thing in your process that you're doing that would be made easier, and do some research on it. See if there's a way to do it, if there's a faster way to do it. And then that's how I've approached it. Like, because you're never, if you try to change all this stuff all at once and then have all these things, you just don't learn it that well
or intuitively get
to
learn.
Yeah. So slowly add things to your arsenal as you're editing and solve like, okay, this is taking me a while. Is there a better way to do this in the future? And that's kind of how I approach it.
So with regard to editing, let's say you got a long shot you're gonna do even when you're doing let's say you're providing an interview from a video for an abandoned video, for example.
Yeah.
What do you typically do though to make that media a little more attractive for your audience, where they're not they're not wandering from looking at it? It's,
Yeah. So like when you click on it, you're watching it. What keeps
them
on?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, there's a lot of things. Some of it is keeping it paced well. It is learning how to pace your content correctly, because not every content is going to be paced at the same time or the same way. Ours, we do cut out a lot of breaths. I do leave some in to keep it natural as much as possible, but you want like that nice pace. One of the things I do, and specifically tell a lot of people who help us edit in different regards, is to treat them like almost like segment, like each segment as its own video. So you'll notice we don't really crank music a lot, because I don't, except for specific moments. You really got to keep your music like -20, -25 decibels below the voiceover volume or the talking volume, and then ramp it up at specific moments when you want to add that dynamic. Because if you just have it like blasting the entire time, or even loud, you just lose any dynamics you can play around with that content.
Yeah. Music. Do you notice any audience retention drop from that at all? Or
not typically. No. Not usually. Like if you're doing things too loud and they like, I haven't in a while. Let's just put it that way. It's, you really do want to keep it lower, and you want to pick specific music that fits well with it. And you'll notice on a lot of our videos, our styles change from video to video. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, big things I do is I'm always looking for good music every time I'm doing a project, because a lot of times I'll help build a lot of it around the music, and the music will help me come up with ideas on how to like make intros or do this like interesting little piece to kind of make it interesting. But in general, I like to make my intros a little bit more story driven, or a little bit more like you want to capture their attention. Like, this is the topic we're talking about. This is why it's interesting. And here's a little kind of little tidbits that you can expect in the video. Let's talk about it. Fun intro. We don't like, you'll notice the only one that we really do the same is the abandoned intro, because it's just fun. But past that, we don't really do, everything's different. We usually have we either don't have an intro, we do something that's different or funny that relates to the thing. So it's always different, and it's never like the same intro, because you don't really want to do, if you're going to do an intro, keep it to like 3 seconds. Or if even that, you don't want that. That's like, people are going to drop off. They're going to go past it. So I'm usually looking to keep that first 30 seconds really high. Like for the most part on our first 30 seconds on our videos, usually we usually have like 70 to 77% retention rates.
Oh, so, that's awesome. Yeah.
Experimenting with that, learning how to segment your video in a way. A lot of it does come down to like good writing and understanding like structure. Not all of our videos are great, but like looking at it and then like reconfiguring it to fit a good narrative and then fitting things in. One thing I like to really do is find little interview segments or little clips from the internet that are related to our content or something and add them in. And you don't ever want to use that kind of content that takes away from like for fair use. You really don't want to take it away where it's like they couldn't go watch that video and it's like the same thing as watching it on your channel. You want to use it to either explain something or to add it in. But I use them as almost like little, I would say, brain breaks. If we're talking about something really technical, you'll want to give people like a little bit of time, you know, like to process it and move on. Otherwise, if you're just like, bam, bam, information, like eventually they're going to lose it. But if you give them like their brain, just like a little bit of a break with some other kind of content besides like your voice or changing the music or like doing something funny, it helps them process. It helps them stay on the video. So you want to like, as you're watching it, a really good test is like you watching it or getting someone else to watch it and like check to see the moments that they like, they like tune out of the content or that you feel like you're tuning out of the content. And you're like, okay, what is making me do that? And how can I like adjust that? So we usually go through several rounds of like, I'll send it to my writers. My writers will give me pretty good feedback. Like, and then I'll show it to different people if we have time. But you kind of learn how to make little adjustments and edits to like your content to get people to continue to watch. It doesn't always work. There's some stuff it's going to be like, you know, if we have 20 minute content, like you're probably only going to have like 30 by the end of it, maybe like 30% of people watching till the end, which is fine.
Yeah.
Like when you have longer content, that's to be expected. It's just trying to keep that graph, that engagement graph when it comes down right from that, just like keep it nice and steady, you know, through the rest of the thing. And as long as you can do that and it's just like a slow gradual decline, you're great. It's when you just have like big dips. That's the big problem. Yeah,
that's struggle. Well, I'm just going to say this. I know from you know YouTube video intros, you know they usually say you know don't do them because you know they're usually not appropriate or whatever. But I don't know what you were like. I skip those usually, but I do have to say the abandoned camera intro. I don't know what the sounds or something. Mm-hmm. To me, I just turn it up. I pay attention to those.
And some of that's music selection and some of that's also because it's funny.
How did you do that? Like, did you like, I mean, do you source the audio or did you like mix it yourself or?
Yeah. So, I mean, I got it from Artlist, but I mean, it is like, it's definitely not cut that. I mean, I cut it that way. So I'm very, a lot of our music, a lot of people are like, oh, is that custom music? Where'd you get that from? I'm just really good at like cutting music together to make it work for specific things. And I think, if there's one thing people should really pay attention to, it's like don't just be like quick to pick your music. Take time to think about how this music relates to your subject. And then even like maybe make some music that like maybe is like a little out there. Like I like to pick music that maybe is not necessarily like a typical genre or like, you know, you'd normally hear on YouTube. I like to pick some out there weird music or do like funny things with the music, even like with vocals and different things to kind of like shake it up. That way people it's just like a little bit different. And then even like theming videos or theming sections a certain way. Like if it's about something dark and sinister, don't like overplay it. Find something that works. Yeah. And there's different like frequency levels and there's different like I could go do a whole video on like song selection and how to pick it, but a lot of it is personal preference and just playing around with things. But
how long does it usually take you to, you know, when you're doing song selection, like, is there a time where you just say, okay, forget it, I got to move on? Or do you just say, no, this video, it isn't right, so I'm not going to release it yet. It's going to sit until it's right.
I don't do that very often. A lot of times I'll just like, okay, the video is good as it is because it's like, after a while you could just stare at something for a while, but, and like there's problems with it, but most of the time most people won't notice the problem. So as long as like the problems aren't like in the content, like structure of it. And it's just like a couple little, like, I don't really care. I mean, we're making YouTube content. I'm not making a film that's going to, you know, it's going to be expected. I'm going to have mistakes and I can't be perfect on it. If I'm trying to be perfect on it, then I'll never finish all my projects and I have a billion other things. So at some point you gotta just end it. You gotta come to like, okay, it's an acceptable place. Sure. There's probably a couple of things, whatever, but most of it's stuff that no one would even realize. And like, you always have to ask, does this app even add value to it? Like sometimes I love, like, you have to also pick and choose, like the whole video shouldn't just be like a mass graphics. Like a lot of people do that. It's great if you do that, but it's very time consuming. Do you have to like do these ornate graphics to like convey something, or is there a way that you can convey it that's entertaining, but it's also easier to do? And that's kind of what I look at when I do stuff. Now we also do like crazy graphics, but a lot of those, like I have presets, I have built that over time.
Yeah, actually related to that too, with regard to the presets that you use, you know, what are some recommendations for the best ways to save time in general? We kind of covered a little bit of it.
Find pain points, figure out what exactly you're going to be reusing and your editing style, and like find resources that you can build around that, that are easy to manage, that are easy to manage in storage, and that are not, that don't take forever to like process or to edit, or you've got to go through all these like hoops. Like there's all these like programs I would love to use, but I'm not going to use them because they're not integrated into the software that I'm using, unless it's something very specific. So I try to find things that I don't have to go searching for very far, or I have to like go through multiple steps. The less steps that gets it into the project that keeps my creative flow going is the better, because as a creative, when you're editing, it is so easy to get distracted and just have your, like, you could be going, and then it's like, then you're trying to like do this one thing and it takes forever, and then you just lose all momentum and then your project slows down. So figuring out those pain points that you typically have in your edit with the content you're doing and figuring out how to manage those is very key into learning how to make it fast. Like I said, you process this over time, but like definitely slowly kind of figure it out.
Now, question for you, specifically though, is when you know, like, how did you start out, and then what would you recommend maybe for somebody else that's trying to start out? Like,
yeah, I have a weird back history that's a little like, I don't have a degree in film. I have a degree in business, but I've always been interested in film, and I like, at this point, I mean, the amount of research and stuff I know, I mean, I basically probably almost have a college degree in some of the stuff. I mean, we have so many people, like, it's weird. Like there's even like when we were in Toronto at this film school with this professor, like half of his, like I think he said like a quarter or half of his students knew who I was and watched my content. So it's kind of weird being on that side, but to get into like doing film, I mean, in doing all this, I kind of started more from a social media side of it. I more of a marketing kind of person in general. That just happens to also like have an affinity for doing film, and really like worked my butt off trying to learn how to do it well. So I think it's just like, take advantage of the opportunities that you have. Make sure that you're ready for those opportunities. Learn how to, because the biggest problem I see is that people don't, like, you could be the greatest camera person, greatest artist, like in that sense. Probably there's a bunch of people that are way better than me. But you really got to learn how to deal with clients. You know, you have to understand a little bit more business sense. You have to understand, like, when you're on jobs, you're not just there to film. You're also there to, like, communicate with them, to go to dinner and like, I mean, there's this whole process behind it. And I think some of the business side helps me out a lot, because I understand that side of it. And I understand that like half of it's not even about the project. It's about like building relationships with people and getting them to be able to trust you in circumstances. That way they'll keep coming back to you. Like most people won't even know, like a good video from a bad video. I've had clients that have cried over videos, and I'm like, I don't know why you're crying over this video. But you see, you know, so it's like, deliver the best product you can, give the best advice you can. But at the end of the day, like, it is about relationship building, and that's what business is. So if you really do want, you do need to learn a little bit. It's a little bit more than just about having the best camera and like knowing how to edit the best. You got to know how to work with your client and work within their specific needs and learn when you're pushing and how far to push and when not to push and when to just accept that, like, okay, this is what they want. Like, so I guess that's my best advice. Like, you need, like, it's great that you're good at filming and putting videos together, but you need to learn the business side of it. And you need to think about that a little bit more.
Thanks to everyone for listening to today's Voyager Ungraded podcast. Please be sure to give us a 5-star rating and help us move up those podcast rankings. And also feel free to reach out to us anytime if you have any more questions. And be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel to participate in our live stream podcast events.